Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. A Brief History of Seven Killings is a work of fiction. But it also follows the contours of history. It includes an assassination attempt against Bob Marley in the 70s. It includes the CIA and Jamaican politics and South American drug cartels, the crack epidemic in the 80s, and a lot more. It's a sprawling, ambitious, eventful book. And in 2015, it won the prestigious Man Booker Prize for its author, Marlon James. That was the first time that a Jamaican writer had ever won the award. And shortly after he won the prize, James told an interviewer that his next project was going to be epic. Literally. He was going to write a three-volume fantasy epic that he described as an African Game of Thrones. Over the last few years, he's delved into African folk tales and history. He's revisited the canonical fantasy novels of Tolkien. And as always, he's been absorbed in pop culture and music of all kinds. Marlon James calls his series the Dark Star Trilogy. The first book has just been published, and it's called Black Leopard, Red Wolf.
Leopard got to me before I got to the river, still on four paws, a dead antelope in his mouth. That night, he watched in disgust as I cooked my portion. He had changed back into a man and was on two legs, but eating the antelope leg raw, ripping away the skin with his teeth, sinking into flesh and licking the blood off his lips. I wanted to enjoy flesh the way he enjoyed flesh. My burned and black leg disgusted me as well. He gave me a look that said he could never understand why any animal in these lands would eat prey by burning it first.
A profile of Marlon James just ran in The New Yorker, and it was written by Gia Tolentino. Here's Gia with Marlon James.
This entry into fantasy and the book that resulted, it originated in a lot of places. You know, mm-hmm. You were telling me you researched 14th century Malian history. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you are a lifetime lover of genre of all sorts, but especially fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the places it came from is you got into an argument about The Hobbit movie in 2012.
Right.
Can you describe that argument?
It wasn't even the movie. It was when they announced the cast.
13 dwarves and a halfling. Strange traveling companions, Gandalf.
These are the descendants of the House of Durin.
And I'm like, you know, this is one really white cast. And the friends I was with, one of the friends mentioned that, well, you know, it's British, it's based on British mythology and Celtic mythology and so on. I think he was trying to find a way of just telling me that Lord of the Rings is white.
Mm-hmm.
There's an inn, there's a merry old man. An old gray hill, and there they brew a beer so proud. The man in the moon himself came down one night to drink his fill.
And I said, you know, if we went to the Shire and saw an Asian hobbit, nobody would have cared.
Right. It's this thing where people can imagine a whole imaginary world, but not imagine black people in it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Which is not a reflection of the novel, of course, which I adore and take from. But I just got tired of that debate. I got tired of the question about inclusion and then the backlash against asking for inclusion. I was like, you know what? I'll just build my own damn universe.
Right. Well, so the genre that you're writing in has often been defined by this perspective that is kind of explicitly colonialist.
Mm-hmm.
And like sci-fi is like, it's sort of a proto-Western with people mm-hmm. striding, you know, to find, you know, new worlds and conquer them,
mm-hmm.
right? And then fantasy is like pale heroes on horseback protecting the countryside from the mm-hmm. orcs, right?
Yeah.
But then at the same time, there's this counter tradition of black sci-fi or black fantasy,
mm-hmm.
and lately fantasy that is like your book rooted in, you know, African diasporic traditions.
Mm-hmm. In some ways, it's a wider list when you're thinking about African literature, largely because those distinctions wouldn't have happened.
Right. The supernatural works completely different in
mm-hmm.
African folk tradition.
Precisely.
And in, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was thinking it's like arguably you love, I know you love Toni Morrison,
mm-hmm.
Arguably beloved even, it has a foot in almost like horror fantasy. It's
yeah, it is. It is. It has a foot in gothic. It has
right.
a foot in the darker side of magical realism. You know, Beloved and Song of Solomon both recognize that if we're going to tell stories about black and brown people and so on, then our conventions of reality are different. You know, at the end of Song of Solomon, you are supposed to believe that we can fly.
And you've also talked about Marquez. The first time you read Marquez, you were like this is magical realism, but it's also
Caribbean reality. It wasn't magical to me.
Right.
It wasn't magical to me. In fact, it legitimized the crazy thoughts in my head.
Yeah.
And Marquez also said it. If you live in the Caribbean, and I always love that he called himself a Caribbean writer. Mm-hmm. You know, if you live in the Caribbean, you know that reality is wilder than the craziest fiction. So I was reading quite a bit of contemporary and not so contemporary African fiction and sci-fi and fantasy. But what I ended up reading was a lot of the ancient African epics. So the epic of Sundiata, the Lion of Mali, the epic of Askia Muhammad, which has the floating city Go. There's an epic about a cannibal witch who is outsmarted only by her own daughter. And then she dies of old age, which I thought was just badass. This sort of absence of the surreal and the supernatural being a mark of realism, whatever that might mean, has always seemed ludicrous to me. To me, the most realistic novel I wrote was Brief History of Seven Killings. And it still opens me with a narration from a ghost.
Right. So when people say, what's your new book about? What do you say?
I just say it's me trying to write a kind of African epic story I always wanted to read.
Right. So the book is, you know, mostly it's through the narrator is this guy Tracker, basically sort of a career bounty hunter with this magically gifted nose for sniffing people out. But he, you know, he joins this motley crew of people that are hunting for the boy. My personal favorite among them is the wise buffalo who joins halfway. The crew is very motley, though. The buffalo, I think one of the reasons that I liked him is that he was consistently... He's not predictable, but you do trust him and you know he's good. It's not quite the same for all of the other seekers. And I was wondering, who was your favorite character to write? And if you could talk a little, like, of the search party. And you can't pick the narrator.
Okay. I wouldn't have picked him anyway.
It
would be a toss-up between the Ogo, the giant. Again, the giant is such a stereotype of fantasy. And they're always sort of... monosyllabic. Either the gentle giant or the violent grunting giant. And he's just a motor mouth who just won't shut up. And he was so much fun to write. And Soglan was also interesting to write because it's
can you describe her a little bit?
Yeah, you know, some people have called her the Moon Witch. She's 315 years old. And she's the only one in the quest who has a specific agenda for finding this boy. And because of that, she makes some really, really drastic decisions. I like writing characters who I have to have a very complicated relationship with.
Yeah.
And hers was certainly the most complicated. She also is telling the next book. So she's a narrator in the next book. So it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I can't wait. I love your female characters. They're all so tricky. So the next book will be narrated by Soglan, and then the next one by an undisclosed third narrator. And so the structure of this trilogy is notably different. It's sort of Rashomon-esque.
Right.
It's three people telling different versions of the same quest. And it's also like the Showtime series The Affair.
Right.
And that was, in a way, your inspiration.
Mm-hmm. When I look back, I can't tell you why it happened.
Ms. Bailey, why don't you tell me how it began?
It was so long ago. Who remembers?
It was a discussion about it. I was talking to Melina Matsoukas, at the time director of Insecure. And at the time, I'd been researching this novel for 2 years, and I still couldn't figure out how to tell the story. And she was talking about The Affair and how it's different perspectives on the same story, and the stories don't add up. And she was saying, you know, this is a great idea for a TV show. And then I'm like, forget the TV show. This is a great idea for a novel.
For my novel. Okay, best affair in literature.
Best affair in literature is very easy for me, actually. It's The Affair in the End of the Affair. Graham Greene.
Cool.
Novel, which I also think is the best novel about an affair. And the film is actually pretty good.
I've never seen it.
Julianne Moore, who should have won the Best Actress Oscar for it. It's one of those... one of those, how did the Oscars miss it kind of films. The End of The Affair, highly recommend it.
So I was on an Edith Wharton kick while we were hanging out, and and it was funny. We ended up talking about a lot of novels in the canon of literary fiction, and you had some unexpected affinities, which so tell me who your favorite Pride and Prejudice character is and why.
Favorite Pride and Prejudice character? Damn. You know what? So, of course, I love the hero. I love Elizabeth. And I love Darcy, even before Darcy became likable.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the people everybody don't like. Yeah. Everybody else don't like. I really love Mrs. Bennet. The thing I like about Austen is that even her unsavory characters can sometimes be the only people who know what time it is.
Mm-hmm.
And Mrs. Bennet is one of the few people in that novel who knows what time it is. I mean, fine, she's shrill, so sexist, and so on. But
now people got to eat, you know?
Yeah, but she's the only person who realized, I need to get these women married
right.
because these women are running out of time.
Right, right.
And I love her.
Is there, you don't have to answer this,
yeah.
but okay, what's your least favorite, like, canon novel?
Oh, God, Wuthering Heights.
I hate Wuthering Heights,
too. I keep trying. I tried last year's summer. It was the third time I tried. I just don't think it's this sort of deeply psychological novel that people think. For one thing, I just don't think Emily Brontë had the psychology. It's like if you read Salman Rushdie's novel, Shame, the sisters, Chunny, Money, and Bunny, who grew up in isolation and think they understand the world. If one of those three girls wrote a novel, it would be Wuthering Heights.
Let's go back to your childhood, your childhood influences. You told me that you spent your childhood in a middle-class suburb of Kingston, watching Charlie's Angels, reading comic books, et cetera. What was your earliest comic book fascination?
Earliest comic book fascination would have been Batman.
But then later, X-Men became your thing, right?
Yeah, huge, huge touchstone. The whole sort of identifying. I was a nerd, I was an outcast, they were outcasts. It really struck a chord with me.
Was there any X-Men in particular that you...
I really love Storm.
Yeah.
Storm because she was black and African, but I actually liked when she went suddenly punk rock in the 80s because I always wanted a mohawk. And I always envied somebody so really radically defining herself. I like some of the villains, too. I mean, like Mystique. Mystique had secrets, and Mystique was complicated. It was very different from the type of villains who just say curses, found out again, or something. Or people talking about these meddling kids. X-Men sometimes would win the battle, but Mystique won the ideological war. It's like, don't kid yourself. You went against our kind to defend people who will kill you tomorrow.
She's right.
You know, she and a lot of the villains left a really, really sort of complicated aftertaste in my mouth.
So you, like me, have music on constantly, and you always have it on really loud. And you have talked about when you're writing, you will note on your manuscript pages what you were listening to as you wrote. And I was wondering, what was the album you listened to most while writing the new book?
Most while writing the new book. Probably Miles Davis' Bitches Brew. Cannes' Tago Mago. Stereolab's Dots and Loops. It gets me in a rhythm, and I think I write to rhythm, and I think I write to beat.
Well, another question. So Tracker, your narrator, is this sullen, slippery, kind of tough guy who has kind of lost faith in this enchanted world around him. If he were a person alive right now, what do you think he would listen to?
You know, he'd be listening to Vince Staples.
Because
Vince Staples is wry and sarcastic. Vince Staples is the guy who did that whole GoFundMe. Say, okay, you want to get me out of the world? Pay me to leave.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You would totally, hell, you would be Vince Staples.
Thank you for coming in and talking to me.
You need me to say something too? Like, thanks for having me.
Marlon James talking with The New Yorker's Gia Tolentino.